Okay, so Rhyme Tovim, everybody. Erev Tov in Israel, and everybody should be well. Chodesh Tov, it should be a Chodesh Mishanich Nasadar Marvin B'Simcha, Simcha, and Shalom. We should be Zochah to a modern day Purim in the very near future. But okay, well, it's a pleasure to welcome back Shuli as we continue on with her series on biblical archaeology, and we'll get started right away. Vakasha.
Okay, thank you so much. I feel like we should learn in the schut that there should be peace. So let us get started. So what we're going to do today, last week we did a little introduction to Sefer Melachim, and we talked about King Solomon and his cities. Today we're going to zoom in on one, probably the most dramatic and the most interesting story to talk about in all of Melachim, Aleph and Bet, and that's the stories of Eliyahu, right? Eliyahu takes up quite a lot of space in Sefer Melachim. A lot of different chapters about him. And if you count Elisha, we really have quite a lot of room to talk about these stories. And they're actually both fascinating Nevi'im. We're not going to really talk about Elisha. We'll mention him a little in passing, but he's also fascinating. But they are both, and the sources are, today we actually do have a lot of sources. The sources are in the chat right now. They are both very, very interesting prophets because they have certain characteristics that we don't see in later prophets or in earlier either, right? First of all, they are, while they are Nevi'im, and really I'm just going to talk about Eliyahu now. He's a Navi to the kingdom of Israel, right? We're at the point where the kingdoms have split, but yet we're going to see in a moment in the map, he is active all over the country, right? We don't hear about him in Jerusalem, but we really do hear about him in so many other places. And he is down in areas that are the territory of Yehuda, like Beersheba, for example. And he's really active all over the country. Elisha as well. They are Nevi'im who take up a lot of space in Tanakh, and yet they have not left behind anything written, right? We don't have any books by Eliyahu. We don't have a book by Elisha. They are also fascinating in the sense that they are both, there's a lot of focus on miracles, right? We hear a lot about these wild miracles, bringing people back to life and bringing down fire from the heavens and making water appear out of nowhere. And in fact, if you know your New Testament, right, you know that a lot of the things that Jesus does are really just kind of copies of what Eliyahu and Elisha do. It's a copycat, you know, miracle. And so that's also fascinating. What's going on there? And part of the answer, at least for Eliyahu, I think, is that he has to deal with a very powerful nemesis. And what we're going to set up today in this class is we're going to set up the two sides of the story, right? We're going to see Eliyahu and who he is and what he's fighting for and what's important to him. We're going to play devil's advocate, and we're going to look at the side of the king of Ahab and what does he have to lose, right? And then we're going to see how they meet up and what happens. But Ahab is, and his father before him, Omri, are very interesting because in Tanakh, usually the way it works, not always, but often, is a righteous king does well by God, does well by man. And because he is a righteous king, think of Chizkiyahu, think of Yoshiyahu until the end of his life. Because they are righteous kings, they are also successful kings. On the other hand, kings that are not righteous, that do a lot of idolatry, they're not so successful. Their dynasties fail. They fall apart. They don't have power. Ahav is a paradox because he is a very, as we're going to see, he is a very successful king militarily, economically, creates good alliances. And he's a really bad guy, right? He's bad on the level of Ben Adam Lamakom. He is very involved in idolatry. His wife brings in all this idolatry into his home. And he is bad on the level of human interaction, Ben Adam Lachavero, and how he treats other people, as we're going to see in the story of Navot. So here you have this person who we would say theologically, right? Rasha v'tovlo. He's wicked and things go well for him. How do you combat that? You need a very powerful prophet. You need a prophet who can show that he has God on his side, right? Not just have God on his side, but actually show that he has God on his side. Right? The picture that I brought you here, I have to say, is probably my favorite picture from the Eliyahu story. This is an enlargement of a piece of a famous synagogue that was discovered in Syria, discovered less than 100 years ago. And it's a synagogue called Dura Europus. If you've been to the museum to Beit HaTfutzot, renamed the Anu Museum, they have copies of these walls, these paintings in the museum. Okay. This is a synagogue from 3rd century, 4th century of the Common Era. It's a very early synagogue. And what's fascinating about it is it was preserved, and it was preserved with these incredible colorful wall paintings, because we all know that sometimes sitting in shul can get a little boring. So if you are bored and you don't have, you know, this is in the era before they had those nice little parsha sheets that you sit and read, you look up and you look at the walls, and the walls are telling you a lot of stories, right? And the stories are Bible stories, but they are Bible stories with the addition of midrashim. So what you have here is a great picture of the prophets of the Baal on Mount Carmel. The story that we're going to tell right now is a very important story. And they are, you know, getting their altar ready, right? And we're going to see the challenge. Eliyahu challenges them. You set up an altar. I'll set up an altar. You put an animal on. I'll put an animal on. You try to call down fire from the Baal, from the idols, and I'll try to call down fire from God. And of course, we know the Baal is not going to be able to do anything. And the prophets of the Baal know that too. Now, in the story, as we're going to read, they're not successful. In the Midrash, right? The Midrash adds, and the Midrash says they know they're not going to be successful. They're no dummies, hey? And somebody says, what are they wearing on their right sides? I think that this is meant to be knives, right? Because in the story, they're jumping around and they're cutting themselves. And the stripes on their clothes, by the way, show that they're important people, because that's what important people wear, stripes. But in the Midrash, they know they're not going to be able to bring down fire. So what do? They enlist someone to help them, an assistant. And that's this fellow here. He's in a little cubbyhole inside the altar, and he's getting ready with his matches and his kindling, and he's going to make the fire happen. Who is this guy? This guy is someone named Chiel Beit Ha'eli. We hear about him in Tanakh. He's the guy who defies the decree of Yoshua from hundreds of years earlier, and he rebuilds the city of Jericho. Okay, so he's a good choice for an accomplice to the prophets of the Baal. But the Midrash says it doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Because Eliyahu figures it out. And he says, God, send something to kill Chiel Beit Ha'eli. So God sends a nice snake. And Chiel Beit Ha'eli, that's the end of him. And the plot does not work, right? So it's a great illustration of the story, but we are getting a little ahead of ourselves. So let's understand, where are we? Where do the stories take place? Okay. We today are going to speak about three different places, but like I said, Eliyahu is in lots of places. We are going to speak about a place called the Muhraka, right? The southern end of the Carmel Mountains. Okay. Carmel Mountain is very large. Right. It goes all the way down towards Zichron Yaakov. Right. So this is one piece of the Carmel Mountain, not the southern edge, the eastern edge, right? Closest to the Jezreel Valley. We're going to talk a little about the Jezreel Valley that we have mentioned quite a few times before. We're going to go to Megiddo, which we were in last week, but now we're going to hear about it as Ahav's chariot city. Okay. And we're going to finish up in Yisrael. Okay, where we have the story of Navot the Yisraeli. Okay, so we're going to be in the Carmel, we're going to be in Megiddo, and we're going to be in Yisrael, and all of these are on the edges or in the middle of the Jezreel Valley. Okay, so that's where we are going to be today. What else are we going to see? So we're not going to see all these stories, right? We're going to allude to a few of them, but this is what I wanted you to see. This is a great map because it shows you how far and wide Eliyahu travels, right? If you wanted to do a real tour, like in real time, of following in the footsteps of Eliyahu, you would need at least a week, and you'd need to take your passport, right? Because he's going all over the place. He comes from, right? We know from our song, right? But you might know it also from Tanakh. Eliyahu is HaGiladi. He comes from Gilad, okay, on the other side of the Jordan, okay? He appears suddenly and declares a drought. We're going to talk about that in a minute. He hides out in a place called Nahal Krit, which this map puts over here, but it's not necessarily over here. It could be on the other side of the Jordan. And then when the drought gets really bad, he goes all the way up north to Tzarfat in what is today Lebanon. Then he ends up by Mount Carmel. Then he runs away from Ahav and Izebel, and he goes down to Beersheba and all the way down to the Sinai. Then he comes back and he meets up with Ahav in Israel. He also meets up with Elisha, right? He's all over the place. Now, one of the fascinating things, Rav Yisrael Rosenson wrote a lot about Eliyahu. We're going to talk about him. And Rav Samet also talks a lot interesting stuff about Eliyahu. Rav Rosenson says Eliyahu is a very mysterious figure. He comes out of nowhere. We're going to read that in 1 minute. He disappears into nowhere, right? He goes up in the fire, right? In the chariots of fire. And some of the things that happen, we don't know where they happen. Where is he when he first declares that the drought should happen? Where is he when he meets up with Ahav before the battle on Har HaCarmel? A lot of times we don't know where things happen. So when the Tanakh bothers to tell us where something happens, it's usually because that's a significant place, right? Eliyahu has his encounter with the still small voice of God. Where? In the Sinai Desert, right? Eliyahu is clearly, there's some parallels going on to Moses, to Pinchas, right? We have a lot of different parallels. Why Mount Carmel? We'll talk about Mount Carmel. When we hear about specific places, often it's for a reason. So that's good to keep in mind as we go along. But he really is traveling all over the country and very involved in many, many different places. The first time we hear about Eliyahu shows up out of nowhere, right? We have no idea who he is. What's the backdrop? What's happening in the chapter right before? We have a lot of unrest in the kingdom of Israel. Okay. The lineage of Baasha comes to a violent end. We have a coup. Then we have another coup. Then we have a very strong king who comes along. His name is Omri. He's going to make himself a new capital. He rules very powerfully. He establishes order, reestablishes order after all of these coups and this instability. And his son is Ahav, who rules twice as long as him and is even more powerful. Okay. And that's the context. And then suddenly out of nowhere, we have two strange things. First of all, we hear at the end of chapter 16 that this fellow, Chiel Beit Ha'eli, comes along and decides he's going to rebuild Jericho. Just to remind us, right, when Jericho is conquered by Joshua, he says anyone who rebuilds a city, it should stay unbuilt because this is a tel olam. It should be something that will always be remembered, that this is the first place that God helped the Israelites conquer in the land of Israel. And anyone who rebuilds Jericho, there's going to be a curse on him. When he starts to build, his first son will die. And when he finishes his house, his last son will die. And for hundreds of years, nobody rebuilds in Jericho until along comes this fellow, Chiel Beit Ha'eli. And indeed, the curse actually happens. His first son dies when he starts to build his house. His last son dies when he finishes his house. But this does not seem to deter him. And from that point on, people live in Jericho. And after that, seems to be coming out of nowhere. After that, we have Eliyahu, who literally just shows up out of nowhere. Elijah the Tishbi, an inhabitant of Gilad, said to Ahav, "As the Lord lives, the God of Israel, whom I serve, there will be no dew or rain except at my bidding." Suddenly, there's a drought. What's going on here? Now, we had heard already, this is not that surprising, that Ahav is an idolater. He does things that are very displeasing to God. But even so, it seems very strange. And of course, the Midrash steps in because that's what the Midrash loves to do, right? And it gives this very interesting dialogue, right? Eliyahu and Ahav meet up at the Shiva of Chiel Beit Ha'eli's son. Right? It's fascinating how the Midrash pictures it. And Ahav says to Eliyahu, you know what? I think that the student is more powerful than the teacher, right? What does he mean by that? He says, Yoshua's curse, that came true. But Moshe's curse, what does Moshe say? If you don't follow God's rules and you follow idols, there will be no rain and you won't have any prosperity. And he says, look, I'm worshiping every idol in the world. And look at me, I'm doing just fine. And Eliyahu, we're going to see the theme throughout Eliyahu's career is he is very zealous for God. As the Midrash puts it, he cares very much about Kvod Ha'av, as in the father as in God, and not about Kvod HaBen, and not about the people of Israel, and he needs to learn to balance that. But Eliyahu is very distressed by this insult to Moshe's power, to God's power. And so he immediately declares a drought, which is a fascinating thing because he's human, right? How is he able to stop the rain, right? The Gemara talks about how there are keys. There are certain keys that are only in the hands of God, right? Life and death and rain. And yet Eliyahu manages to do this. God obviously allows it. He declares this drought so that there won't be prosperity. And then what happens, which is fascinating, is he has to live with the consequences of the drought. Yes, God agrees that it should happen, but Eliyahu, maybe you should see what happens when you make these kinds of decrees. I just saw there was a question, what's Tishbi? Tishbi is a good question. What does it mean, right? Is it his family? Is it a place? We don't really know. There, Josephus thinks it's a place in the other side of the Jordan. I think Rashi says so too, but we don't have any like concrete answer of what is a Tishbi. So there's another fascinating suggestion. Now, I don't remember who says it, that Tishbi means a Toshav. He's a Ger Toshav, that he's not a native Jew, he's a convert, right? Which is a fascinating idea, which we have absolutely no proof for. But it is interesting based on the language. Okay, so Eliyahu declares this drought, and then he has to go and get himself some water. So where does he go? God says, go to hiding by Nahal Crit, by the Wadi Crit, east of the Jordan. Now, this is Wadi Kelt, the thing that you're seeing in the picture here. Wadi Kelt is this massive, I'm sure some people here have seen it or hiked it, this massive riverbed on the west of the Jordan, right, near Jericho. Christians believe that Wadi Crit is Wadi Kelt. It's not so likely based on the text, but it's a nice picture, so I put it in. Basically, what it means is he has to go into a place that doesn't have a lot of water, and he has to be dependent completely on God. You're taking water away from the people. You also have to worry about water. So he goes to Wadi Crit, and he stays there for a while, and the ravens bring him bread and meat, and he drinks from the wadi, but he's not really getting the point that God is trying to make, which is take a look at the consequences of your actions. Understand what you did. Maybe you need to have a little pity on the people as well. So after some time, the wadi dried up because there was no rain. And the word of God came to him, go at once to Tzarfat of Sidon and stay there. I have designated a widow there to feed you. Maybe when Eliyahu, and this is all following the explanation of Rav Samet, who wrote a beautiful book about Eliyahu. He says, maybe you go and you'll live among the people and you'll see then the consequences. And he goes to this widow and she says, I have no food. And he miraculously makes food appear and he still doesn't get the point. And God makes the widow's son die. And he actually, Eliyahu brings him back to life. And he's not getting it. He's not hopping it. This is something that is very hard for him to see the point of view of the people as opposed to the point of view of God. Okay, let's look in the other direction for a minute. We're always, this is interesting. Tishbi is an anagram for Yevoshet or for Yavesh. Nice. Very nice. Okay, but I'm not looking at the chat anymore, so we'll wait till the end. I know, I get very curious. Okay, so here is the city of Shomron. Omri, remember Omri, Ahav's father, he starts out ruling in the city of Tirza, which is an important city in the Shomron. You may recall it as one of the daughters of Slefchad is Tirza, but a lot of places in the Shomron are named after the people from, you know, from Tanakh. And since she's from Menashe, there's a place named after her. So Tirza was a capital city. Omri, at a certain point, decides that he wants his own capital. He wants a place that is made in his image. He doesn't want something that's going to be with a whole kind of all the luggage of history and religious connotations and other kings. And so what does he do? He buys a piece of land from a fellow named Shemer. The reason Shomron is called Shomron is because it was Mr. Shemer's land. Okay. He buys a piece of land from Shemer and he builds himself a city from the ground up, which is very interesting, right? Not like Jerusalem and not like Shechem. It's not a city that's been around for hundreds or thousands of years, but it's a city that he plans from the beginning. Very central, very secure. Okay. It doesn't have any religious connotations. It's a large capital city. It's larger than Jerusalem was at the time. Okay. And it's like a clean start. And this is going to be one of Ahav's cities. He's going to inherit it from his father. Shomron is very important, but it's not his only city. Ahav, we're going to see, has a city in Megiddo. He's also up north in Tel Dan. He also has a smaller royal compound in Israel. He's a very powerful king. Okay, so we don't have so much left from biblical Shomron, which is today is called Sebastia, because Herod then builds there later, right? But we do have some of the remains of the palace, and one of the things that was found, a bunch of things that were found in Shomron, one of the artifacts was these beautiful ivory carvings. Okay, ivory obviously is a very precious material. It requires a lot of wealth. And we actually hear fascinating, right? The prophet Amos, who's about 100 years after Ahav, 80 to 100 years, he talks about the people of Shomron and their great wealth and how they sleep on ivory beds, mitot shen. Clearly, their bed is not completely made out of ivory. Nobody could possibly afford that. But instead, they have beautiful headboards with these inlays of ivory, and we've actually found them. So you get a sense of the wealth of the city. So that's Shomron, Ahav's capital. Eliyahu, we've seen, has been traveling around because of the drought. And at a certain point, he goes to meet with Ahav and to challenge him to this face-off between him and the prophets of the Baal in order to end the drought, basically. And he says to him, where is this going to happen? It's going to happen on Mount Carmel, right? And here we have a piece of Mount Carmel. Mount Carmel is a very large mountain. We think it's in a particular place called the Muhraka. We'll see where that is in a moment. In the eastern end, closest to the Jezreel Valley. Why does Eliyahu say to meet on Har Carmel? It's a strange choice, right? Some people suggest that it was a cultic site for the Baal. Mountains, high places often are cultic sites. So maybe this is a real challenge to the Baal, right? We're going to see another suggestion from Rev Rosenson in a few minutes of why this is a good place. But first, let's understand where we're talking about. So on this eastern edge of the Carmel, right near the Druze town of Daliat al-Carmel, is a site called the Muhraka. Muhraka is Arabic for burnt. And the tradition is going back to Byzantine times, right, 1500 years ago, that this is the place of the face-off between Eliyahu and the prophets of the Baal. And because of that, it gets that name. And because of that, the Crusaders build a monastery up here. There's a tradition that there was a Byzantine monastery here even before that. And there are monks who are called the Carmelites, the Order of the Carmelites. And that's these dudes in their brown outfits. Right? This is an order that already begins in Crusader times. They have to leave in the 13th century when the Crusaders are kicked out of the land of Israel. But they come back in the 17th century to Haifa and then eventually in the 19th century to the Muhraka and build a church here. Why are the monks here? Because Eliyahu is a fascinating figure. Many figures from Tanakh are important to the Christians. Eliyahu happens to be important to everybody, right? Everybody likes Eliyahu. Eliyahu is holy for Christians. He's holy for Muslims. Muslims call him El Khader, the evergreen one, right? Because he doesn't die. He's holy to the Druze. Everybody has some connection to Eliyahu. He is a very universal figure. Okay? So there's a Christian monastery up here. You can go up and see the view and tell the story, but there's a church there, and there are monks that are up there. Now, when the monks have to leave, in Crusader times, when the Crusaders are kicked out, the tradition of Eliyahu moves up to Haifa. Okay, there's already an older tradition, even a Jewish tradition about Eliyahu having a cave in Haifa. Eliyahu and caves seems to go together. He's always like going off to a cave, hiding in a cave. And so there's a cave in Haifa called Eliyahu's Cave. And today it is a site where Jews come to pray, as you can see. It's right near the sea. Okay? it used to be holy not only to Jews, but today Christians also have a site in Haifa, Stella Maris. This is where the monks come back to in the 17th century, and they build a church here in the 18th century. It's destroyed with the Napoleonic Wars. They build another one in the 19th century, and there's a cave underneath the altar that they say is Eliyahu's cave. So we do have Eliyahu not only in Har HaCarmel, but also in Haifa, but much more likely that the story is taking place here in the Muhraka just because of its proximity to the Jezreel Valley. Because at the end of the story, Eliyahu chases the prophets of the Baal down the mountain, kills them by the Wadi, by the Nahal Kashish, and then he runs before Ahav's chariot through the Jezreel Valley. So it's geographically, it fits very nicely. And when you go up on the Muhraka, you can see this statue, which is a really scary statue. Whenever I see, I'm there with people, I always say, would you invite this man to your Seder? You would not want this man to come to your Seder. Right? He's a scary guy. And this is very much Eliyahu of Tanakh. This is very much Eliyahu of how the Christians see Eliyahu, as this very vengeful prophet. As we're going to see at the end today, Jewish tradition has softened Eliyahu after his Tanakh career. But in the Tanakh, he is the kind of guy who will slice off the head of the prophet of the Baal and stand on his neck, right? That's very much like him. Now, the statue here is actually a relatively new statue. There was originally a statue that was brought in 1914 from Bavaria. But in World War I, the Turks were very suspicious of anything coming from outside, and they damage it. They think there's maybe some kind of arms inside. They cut off a hand, and it disappears at a certain point, perhaps in 1948. And then in the 60s, there was a Christian sculptor from Nazareth who decided to make a new statue, and he made this vengeful Eliyahu. And it has different quotes around it. And one of them is from Ben Sira. Okay, Ben Sira is not a book of Tanakh, but it was a book of wisdom that was very respected by Jews. All right, it says, Eliyahu arose a prophet like fire, and his words burned like a torch. And Eliyahu's theme is fire, right? Eliyahu's theme is fire. Elisha's theme is water, right? They're very different, even though one is the student of the other. And the Abarbanel, I brought it only in Hebrew, I apologize, but I'll translate it. The Abarbanel writes a fascinating thing. Whenever I read this, I always say, I can't say this, but the Abarbanel can say it, right? We know Don Yitzchak Abarbanel lived at the time of the expulsion from Spain, an incredible Bible commentary, and he doesn't mince words. It doesn't disturb him to say things that we might say that's a little heretical, right? So what does he say? This is when he's talking about the end of Eliyahu's life, where what does he do? He crosses over the Jordan, leaving the land of Israel, and he goes up in this chariot of fire. Okay. Kineim kein lefishim Moshe ahavet haaretz hanivcharet v'gadal cheshko elah nikbar b'tocha. Moses loved the Holy Land, and he was very desirous of it, so he was buried in it. I'm not sure what he means by this, because we know he wasn't, but maybe because he sees it before he dies. I don't know. But Eliyahu, omnam Eliyahu shelo hayalo imao ta'ava v'cheshek, right? Eliyahu did not have that love and longing for the land. Aval haya ha-hefech, he was the opposite. Shahaya sone ota ve'et anasha umitpalel al tsa'ara. This is the part I wouldn't say, right? He hated the land, he hated the people, and he prayed for troubles to come to the land. V'haya kol me'odo im ha'esh. Everything about him was fire. V'lachein horido b'har ha-Karmel. He brings down fire on Mount Carmel. V'nir elo b'chorev. And he sees the fire when he's in the Sinai. Right? V'horido al sarei ha-chamishim. And he brings down fire on the army officers of Ahav. It was his privilege that he wasn't buried in the land. The lo kubal b'tocha, and he wasn't accepted into the earth. The kubal b'toch ha'esh shebal kabel panav. It's very fitting. He's a man of fire, and so he's swallowed up by fire at the end of his life. Right? And Eliyahu as this prophet of fire is definitely something that we see very much in Tanakh. Now let's go back to our Har HaCarmel before we get to the actual face-off between them. Okay, so again, Rev Rosenson says something very interesting. He says Har Carmel is on a seam line. It's on a border, right? This part of Har Carmel, it looks out on the Jezreel Valley. It looks out on Shomron, on the heart of the land of Israel. But if you look in the other direction towards the west, you look towards the sea. Now, the time period of Ahav is a very troubling time period because people believe in God, but they believe in idolatry as well. And that's exactly what Eliyahu says to them. He says, Ad matay atem poschim al shtei ha-seifim? How long are you going to keep going back and forth between these two things? Do you believe in God or do you believe in the Baal? You can have it both ways. Which one do you believe? You have to make a choice. And by choosing, taking them up on Har Carmel, he says, this is the land where that God chose, Shomron, Israel, right? The land of Israel. And sea is where you go towards Phoenicia, towards Tyre and Sidon. That's where Ahav's wife, Izebel, comes from. And she is the queen of Baal worship. Right? And she brings all this Baal worship. Choose, make a decision. Are you going to choose God? Are you going to choose the Baal? You cannot have it both ways. Now, we hear this and we say, foolish. Why would you believe in this statue, in this figurine? It doesn't make any sense. Now, one of the fascinating things about Tanakh is that Tanakh does not focus on idolatry. It tells you a lot about don't follow idols, but it doesn't tell you very much about what do the idols symbolize, what do they mean, why? Because it's foolishness. You don't need to know what it means, but you do because it helps us to understand the power of what's going on here. Okay, the whole face-off that's going on between Eliyahu and the prophets of the Baal is over rain, right? Eliyahu took away the rain. The prophets of the Baal say they can bring back the rain. They each are fighting for primacy over who has control of the rain. Now, in order to understand why that's such a big deal, you have to understand that the Baal is the god of storms. That is what he does. We have a lot of figures of Baal. He's always looking like that, very angry, about to smite things, right? And that's because he's going to send down lightning and storms. And the Baal is the one who is going to bring the rain, right? And when Eliyahu comes to the people and he says to them, you need to get rid of all that Baal, those little altars and the little statues, and you need to stop praying to the Baal, and then the rain will come. And the people say to him, are you insane? The rain comes from the Baal. If we get rid of the Baal, then we're not going to have any rain ever. And Eliyahu can talk till he's blue in the face about how God says, right, in Sefer Devarim, if you look in the middle here, that when you serve God, then you'll get the rain. But they'll say to him, no, Baal is the one who brings the rain. And we have this poem. I brought you this Ugaritic poem. I don't know if the people knew the poem, but they certainly knew that Baal was the god of rain, right? Parched is the furrow of soil. Parched is El's soil. Baal neglects the furrow of his tillage. When Baal's not around, everything is dry. Everything is crying out for rain. Where is powerful Baal? Where is the prince, lord of the earth? We're going to see in a minute that when Eliyahu makes fun of the prophets of the Baal, he's taking a page from this book. Where are you, Baal? Call a little louder. Maybe he's on a trip. Maybe he's on a journey, right? Does he know this poem? I don't know, but it's fascinating to think about that. But the Baal is a very tempting God, because rain is the most important thing. Here we are thousands of years later, and we are still enthralled to the rain, and we are still so grateful when there's rain. And you can imagine in the days before there's sewage treatment and there's moving water from one place to another, rain is the most important thing. And if this God promises you rain, you're going to worship this God. And even after the miraculous story that we're going to see in a minute, where Eliyahu vanquishes the prophets of the Baal, the people are still going back to the Baal, and we know that. We know that we have records of people's names that are Ish Baal, Miri Baal, right? Baal as part of a name. We have Baal figurines, and here we have in Hosea, who's more than 100 years later, and he's talking about this day, one day, Bahaya Bayomahu Neum Hashem, Tikri'i Ishi, Velo Tikri'i Liod Baali. You will call me Ishi, and you will not call me Baali. This is a play on words. Hosea is talking about his wife who leaves him. and goes and has all these lovers, and she thinks everything that she owns comes from her lovers, but really it comes from her true husband, i.e. the people of Israel and God and the false idols. And one day she's going to understand, she's going to come back, and she's going to love her true husband. And Ishi and Baali, of course, are names for husband, but they're also playing on the Baal, is playing on the name of Baal. Just a very tiny little side note here, just because I love it. When David Ben-Gurion in the 50s was given, he had to sign some bill about employment and compensation, and he signs it, and then he writes a little letter, and he says, you know, you wrote there about the Baal and the Isha, right? The husband and the wife, which is what you say in Hebrew. And he says, that is incorrect, and that's wrong, because it makes it sound like the woman is subjugated to the man. And from now on, I want you all to follow the words of Hosea, and don't use Baali anymore. Use Ishi, Ish v'Isha. And it's just great, because it's David Ben-Gurion applying the Tanakh to his socialist principles. It's just a beautiful thing. Okay, so here's the story. And I realize I always bring too much, but we'll read a little of it, right? So Achav sees Eliyahu, they see each other. Achav is challenged by Eliyahu to bring his prophets of the Baal to Mount Carmel. Okay, and if you look over here, four lines down, Eliyahu approached the people and said, how long will you jump between the two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him, and if Baal, follow him. But nobody's listening. And then everybody sets up this is a great challenge, right? It would make great reality TV. Everybody sets up their altars, right? But they can't put on fire. And then each one has to cry out to their God. Okay, so look down here. They took the bull that was given him. They prepared it and invoked Baal by name from morning until noon. Baal, answer us. Baal, answer us. But there was no sound and no one responded. So they performed the hopping dance and nobody came. And Elijah mocked them and shouted, saying, shout louder. He is a God, but he may be in conversation. He may be detained. Perhaps he is asleep and will wake up, right? That's what I was alluding to before with the poem. So they shouted louder and gashed themselves with knives and spears, but nothing's happening. So finally, it's Eliyahu's turn. And he says to the people, come closer. He fixes up the altar. And then he makes sure that nobody can say to him there's any funny business. He says, fill four jars with water and pour it over the offering of the wood. Do it a second time. Do it a third time. So everything's covered in water. So nothing can be nobody's hiding there to light the match. And then he calls out to God and he says, O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel and I have done all these things that you're bidding. Right? Answer me, O Lord, answer me. Anani Hashem, Anani, right? The Midrash says, why does he say twice? Answer me, answer me. He says, answer me, do the miracle, and then answer me that these stiff-necked people will actually believe that they saw a miracle. Right? Eliyahu knows his crowd. Then fire from the Lord descended and consumed the burnt offering, the wood, the stone, and the water. And when they saw this, the people flung themselves on their faces and cried, the Lord is God, the Lord is God. Hashem hu Elokim, Hashem hu Elokim. What we say at the end of Yom Kippur comes from here. And Eliyahu said to them, seize the prophets of the Baal, and they go and they chase them down the hill and they slaughter them. And then, of course, the end of the story, what was all this about? This was all about the drought. Eliyahu, meanwhile, climbed to the top of Mount Carmel, crouched on the ground, put his face between his knees, and he said to his servant, go and look toward the sea. And he went and he looked and he said, there's nothing. Seven times Elijah said, go back. And the seventh time the servant reported a cloud as small as a man's hand is rising in the west. Now, I will say to you that I've been on top of this site of the Mukhraka many times. And there are times when you go in the winter and you really can see that it's sunny where you are and you can see the rain coming. It's amazing. It really can be seen. And Eliyahu said, go say to Ahav, hitch up your chariot, go down before the rain stops you. The sky grew black with clouds. There was rain and a heavy downpour fell. Ahav mounted his chariot and drove off to Jezreel. And Eliyahu tied up his skirts and ran in front of Ahav all the way to Jezreel, right? He is triumphant. God, of course, is triumphant, but it very much does not last. And that moment, the very next day, he has a price put on his head by Ahab's wife. He has to run away, and we'll continue with his story very soon. But now we're going to cut back towards Ahab. Okay. Now we mentioned Megiddo last time, so we're only going to look at it briefly. But as we said last time, it's a very strategic point. It's a very important place at the gateway to the Jezreel Valley. If you control Megiddo, you control this whole area. But of course, what do you need to control this area? You need to have chariots and horses. And in the time of Joshua and the time of the judges, the people of Israel don't have that. But by the time we get to Ahav, he does. And that's why Megiddo is a very powerful place for him. It's his chariot city. Okay, so Megiddo is a city that has many, many layers. You can see this is a fabulous aerial view of the Tell. The city goes back a millennia, right? It begins in 3400 BCE, and it's an unbroken settlement until 4th century BCE. 3,000 years of settlement in one place, which is astounding. What's even more astounding is that it stops, right? People leave and move somewhere else, and Megiddo is forgotten for centuries. But Megiddo is a city from Canaanite times up until early Second Temple times. This is a great picture of Zalman Shazar, the president of Israel in the 60s, and the Pope meeting Pope John Paul, if I remember correctly, right? And they're meeting when the Pope came for the very first time to the state of Israel, which is a very big deal. Where do they meet? They meet in Megiddo. Why? Because according to Christian tradition, this is where the great war to end all wars is going to take place. Armageddon is Har Megiddo, because there are battles that have taken place here over history. So it's a powerful Canaanite city. We have walls. We have the gate. It was a very wealthy city. We have beautiful ivory from here too. We have evidence of all kinds of trade coming through here. Ritual, temples upon temples upon temples. And eventually it becomes an Israelite city. Now, last time we talked about it as King Solomon's city. We said there are two layers to the city. There's a layer of palaces and a layer of stables, right? One king rules the palaces, and then the next layer is the next generation. And the suggestion is, like I said, not everybody agrees, but many do, that the layer of palaces is King Solomon's city when he makes it an Israelite city. And the layer of stables, meaning there's two separate areas of stables, is Ahab's city, is Ahab's city. Okay? How do we know there's stables? We found these troughs. We found these pillars that you tie the horses to. They found a lot of evidence of actual horses, as in bite marks in the troughs, as in a lot of horse pee in the ground. And what we think is that this Megiddo, because it's in the valley, is the place where Ahav keeps his horses and keeps his chariots. How do we know that he has a whole powerful force of horses and chariots? Okay, because we have this amazing text from a battle that was against the Assyrians, right? This is a local coalition against the Assyrians, who are starting to become powerful. This is a picture of Assyrian horses and chariots on a lion hunt. We're going to talk about the Assyrians next time, and two times, I don't remember. But this is a local coalition of a lot of small kingdoms fighting against the Assyrians. Now take a look at what everybody brings to the party. Okay, King Hadadezer of Aram, 1,200 chariots, 1,200 horsemen, 20,000 soldiers. Irhuleni of Hamat, 700 chariots, 700 horsemen. Okay, Kur Gur'ah, 500 soldiers. Irkanta, 10 chariots. Adinu Ba'al of Usnatu, we don't know, right? Of Arabia, 1,000 camels. King Ahav of Israel, number 3, 2,000 chariots and 10,000 soldiers. In this regional coalition, who is the gorilla in the room? We are, for once. That's very unusual. Okay, so Ahav controls this large force of chariots, of horses. He is a very powerful and very successful king, right? And this is what I said, devil's advocate. This is the other side of the story. Ahav is militarily successful. He's economically successful. He's made a very good marriage. He married Jezebel, who is the princess of Tyre and Sidon, right? Her father is the king in Phoenicia. Phoenicia is a trading powerhouse. And now they are linked by marriage. So he's doing great economically. He's doing great militarily. He has all these cities. He is very fortified. Everything's going great. And along comes this crazy hairy guy. And he says, you're a sinner. You're a terrible person. Get rid of all those Baal temples. Get rid of all that stuff and listen to me. You have to picture him for a minute. Okay. We don't want to disrespect Eliyahu, but look at him through Ahav's eyes for a minute. He's that crazy guy on the subway carrying the sign saying the end is near. He's a nut job. Why would I listen to him? I'm doing really well, right? And that's Ahav's response to Eliyahu. We are very conditioned by Tanakh and by morality, because Ahav's not a good guy, to be on the side of Eliyahu. But just look at it from Ahav's perspective for just a moment, okay? Just to finish up in Megiddo, okay, the city is a city that is very powerful, not just because it has the chariots and horses. It has a great system for having extra grain in time of famine, right? This very large grain storehouse, granary that was built in the center of the city. And it has a very well planned out water system to bring water into the city. This is a city that is clearly ruled by a king that knows what he's doing, right? And is able to provide for his people. So that's just to give us a little bit from the perspective of Ahav. So now we've heard a little about Eliyahu, right? Against the Baal. We've heard a little about Ahav. And now the two are going to meet and they're going to encounter each other. And just to fill us in a little bit, right? In between what happens, after Eliyahu's triumph, Izebel, Jezebel puts a price on his head. He has to run away. He runs away to the desert. He runs away to Beersheba. And then he's just despairing. How much can I fight this? And he leaves Beersheba and he heads out into the middle of nowhere, which is essentially committing suicide, right? Beersheba is the last civilized place. And God doesn't allow him to do that. And he brings him food, right? Miraculously. And then he has him go to the Sinai, right? Mount Sinai, to Har Horev. And he has a vision there. And the vision is what God says, Malacha Po Eliyahu, what are you doing here? And Eliyahu just can't stop saying about how terrible the people are and the people don't listen to me and I'm trying to fight for you. And God brings a storm and God is not in the storm. And he brings a fire and God is not in the fire. And he brings an earthquake and God is not in the earthquake. And then he brings a quiet voice, right? A cold mamadaka, still small voice. And God is in that voice. And again, he asks Eliyahu, Malacha Po Eliyahu, and Eliyahu doesn't change his answer, right? He's unable to say, well, maybe my method of fire isn't working and I need that quiet voice. And at that point, God says, okay, it might be time to hand over the reins to someone else and you have to go and find Elisha, who's going to be your student. But it's not the end of Eliyahu. And he comes back and he encounters Ahav in another one of Ahav's properties, and that is Yisrael. Okay, we have the Yisrael, we have the Amek Yisrael, we have the Valley of Jezreel, but there's also a town of Jezreel. It's right above, you can see the clump of trees down here. This is Ein Yisrael, this is the spring, okay? But right above the spring is where Ahav built himself a very nice palace. It's not a large place. It's like a compound. It's got towers and a moat and a wall and a city gate. And there are remains, by the way, of vineyards. And that's going to be the story that we're going to tell. So this is one of Ahav's kind of more private places that he goes to. And he has, and this is part of the palace, part of the excavations that we found here. We found pieces of mosaics and pieces of towers. And there are remains of the town from the time of Ahav, right? But we have this incredible story where Ahav wants something that seems to be very innocuous, right? He comes to a fellow named Navot, right? And it's after these things that Navot, the Jezreelite, had a vineyard in Jezreel near the palace of Ahav, the king of Shomron. And Ahav speaks to Navot and he says, give me your vineyard and I will have it for a vegetable garden because it's near my house. And instead, I'll give you a better vineyard or I'll give you money, whichever you prefer. Vayomer Navot el Ahav, Navot says to Ahav, Chalila li me'ashem mititi et nachlat avotai lach. How could I, God forbid, that I should give you the inheritance of my fathers. What's going on? What's all the resistance? Why? So you have to understand Am Yisrael in First Temple times. Everybody has a nachala. Everybody has a portion in their tribal area. Land is everything. If you don't have land, you could be very, very rich. Land is what you need. You have to have land. And Navot says, I cannot give up my land to you. I don't care how much you're going to pay me. This is the inheritance of my fathers, and this is what I have to hold on to, right? Now, Achav, in asking for it, is basically, it's a perfect perversion of the king's role. It doesn't seem so terrible, but what is Achav doing? The king's role is to protect the weak and not to take advantage. And here is Achav using his position as king to take something from someone else. Now, granted, and this is what we're going to see right now, he doesn't do it himself, right? And this is actually a fascinating thing. It shows us the power of the Torah, even on people who are idolaters. Okay? Achav was brought up in this culture where there is, you might not be the most benevolent king, but you certainly don't pervert the law for your own purposes whenever you want, right? So he gets this answer, you know, and he's sulky. He's upset because what can he do about it? All right, take a look over here on the fifth line. Achav was dispirited and sullen because of the answer that Nabot the Israeli had given him. I will not give you the land. And he lay down in his bed and he turned away his face and he would not eat, right? He's a perfect teenager, right? He's just going into his room, leave me alone. I'm so upset. And along comes Jezebel. Now, Jezebel is coming from a very different culture. She is coming from a culture where what the king wants, the king takes. And this is not acceptable. You can't just go and sulk, right? So she says, why are you so sad? And he tells her the whole story. And he says, right, now is the time to show yourself in Israel. Rise and eat something and be cheerful. I will get the vineyard of Nabot the Jezreelite for you, right? I'm the one who wears the pants in the family. Now, again, very interesting. She doesn't just send out a soldier to cut off Nabot's head, because that's not going to work. That's going to get a powerful, you know, rebellion against Achav. She has to work within the system. So what's the system, right? She sends out letters to the elders and the nobles, and she makes a fake trial, right? What's the word that I'm looking for? I can't remember when you have a trial that's basically rigged to go against the person, right? But what do they testify? You have cursed. What is it called? A show trial?
A kangaroo court.
That's what I was looking for. Thank you. Okay, but what do they have to testify? You have reviled God and king. You have cursed, right? Why do we care that he curses the king? Because if you curse the king, you're a traitor. And if you're a traitor, you're put to death. But more importantly, your property goes to the king. Okay. And that's what's going on here. So she trumps up these charges. She makes this fast. They testify against him, and that's the end of him, right? And he is then put to death, and his property is going to go to Achav. Word was sent to Jezebel. Nabot has been stoned to death. As soon as Jezebel heard that Nabot had been stoned to death, she said to Achav, go and take possession of the vineyard, which Nabot the Israelite refused to sell you for money, for Nabot is no longer alive. He is dead. Now, Achav doesn't ask too many questions. He's dead. I just saw him yesterday. He doesn't say that. When Achav heard that Nabot was dead, he knows exactly what happens. Achav set out for the vineyard of Nabot the Jezreelite to take possession of it. And the word of the Lord came to Eliyahu the Tishbi, go and confront King Achav of Israel, who resides in Samaria. He is in Nabot's vineyard. He has gone there to take possession of it. Say to him, would you murder and take possession? Which, of course, in Hebrew is much more powerful. Haratzachta v'gam yarashta, right? Which is the classic. It's used till today all over the place in Israeli politics, right? Maybe not actual murder, but you did this dirty deed and now you're also going to take possession, right? And then they have this encounter, right? Achav says to Eliyahu, you have found me, my enemy. I have found you because you have committed yourself to doing what is wrong. Okay. And Achav and Eliyahu facing off against each other. And Achav is going to be terribly punished, right? Except it doesn't quite happen that way. And that's also a fascinating lesson about Eliyahu, right? Achav hears this decree, the dogs are going to lap your blood, right? Very, very terrible ending. And what does he do? I didn't bring you the story here, but if you look at the end of chapter 21, right? When he hears this, what does he do? He goes and he goes and he tears his clothes and he puts on sackcloth and he fasts and he cries. And God says to Eliyahu, did you see that Ahav has submitted to me? I won't bring the end in his time, but I'll wait till after he dies. Now, God is not as we say in Hebrew, he's not a friar. He's not a sucker. He knows that Ahav is only doing this out of incredible fear. Why is God merciful? Because again, Eliyahu needs to learn a lesson. At a certain point, you have to understand the foibles of people and you have to allow them to atone. But Eliyahu doesn't get it. And there's a fascinating midrash, by the way, that Eliyahu, the child that Eliyahu brings back to life is Yonah, who also doesn't like this idea that bad people can atone, right? So what happens with Ahav? He lives out his life. His wife doesn't fare quite so well. She gets eaten by the dogs. That's the second. Well, you guys can read it on your own. And Ahav's line is cut off, right? Ahav's line is cut off. Yehu kills off his son and the prophets of the Baal, and Ahav's line does not survive, but Ahav himself does live out the rest of his life. What about Eliyahu, right? What happens to him? Okay, so the end of the Eliyahu story is, of course, very famous, right? That he goes, he meets up with Elisha. They go from place to place, right? They go from Beit El to Jericho to the Jordan. They cross the Jordan, and then he's carried away in this chariot of fire. So let's just read that for a second. Because the end here is amazing, right? So first of all, where do they go? They're going, and this is again the Abarbanel, they're going in a reverse entrance to the land. When Joshua enters the land, he crosses the Jordan, they go to Jericho, they go near Beit El. Eliyahu is going the opposite direction. Okay. Eliyahu said to him, to Elisha, stay here, for the Lord has sent me to the Jordan. But Elisha doesn't leave him, and they went on, and all these prophets are watching. Thereupon Eliyahu took his mantle, right, his aderet, his robe, and rolling it up, he struck the water. It divided to the right and left, right? We really do have a reenactment of entering the land. The water splits. Well, it doesn't split when they enter, but similar. So the two of them crossed over on dry land, but they're leaving the land. As they were crossing, Eliyahu said to Elisha, tell me, what can I do for you before I am taken from you? Elisha said, let a double portion of your spirit be passed on to me. Okay, that's for a class on Elisha. They kept on walking and talking. A fiery chariot with fiery horses suddenly appeared and separated one from the other. And Eliyahu went up to heaven in a wind, whirlwind. He doesn't die. He's carried away. Why in a chariot? Elisha saw it and he cried, Father, Father, Israel's chariots and horsemen. Avi, Avi, Rechev Israel uParashav. Remember Ahav and his chariots? Okay, what's going on here? Elisha is saying, you thought Ahav and his chariots were the power? Eliyahu and God is the power. And God is the one who makes things successful. And he's the reason for the chariots. So that's a beautiful interpretation of why it happens this way. But Eliyahu's story doesn't end because he doesn't die, right? And in Tanakh, and particularly in rabbinic literature, he keeps coming back, right? So first of all, we have the prophet Malachi, right? Who talks about how he will send Eliyahu before the coming of the day, awesome, fearful day of the Lord, right? Eliyahu is the foreshadowing. He's the mivaser of the Messiah. He shall reconcile parents with children and children with their parents. Eliyahu was never a reconciler, okay? But in his other life, he has to fix up what he did wrong. He has to do a tikkun, where he was always zealous for God, kvod ha'av, okay? Now he has to be zealous for the people of Israel. And that's why in rabbinic literature, where does Eliyahu show up? He comes to every brit. He comes to every Passover Seder. He helps to finish a minyan, right? He has to always be coming back and seeing, look, another baby's being brought into the covenant. Look at all these people remembering the story of the Exodus. Look at all the good things that the Jewish people are doing, Eliyahu. You have to reconcile the parents and the children, God and the people of Israel. So Eliyahu has to, in his afterlife, kind of fix up what he missed out on in his real life. So that's Eliyahu, and he's not the avenging prophet once he gets to rabbinic literature. All right, we got a lot of comments here. What are all these comments? Yes, Achav is killed in battle. It's true. He doesn't live out his life so peacefully. This is correct. Okay, Tishbi. The aqueduct in Wadi Kelt is from the British, and the water is coming from the springs of Wadi Kelt. Yevoshet, I assume that what Gershom meant is like yabasha, is like dryness. Ah, thank you, Susanna explained it. And Eliyahu is famous for declaring a drought. Eliyahu of the Tanakh, okay, this is what we said at the end, right? The Baal's figure looks rather feminine. Oh, you wouldn't say that if you saw it in real life. He's a scary guy, the Baal. Is Barbanel using this as a metaphor for Spain? Oh, very interesting. I don't know. You have to know somebody who knows more about the Baal. Ishi is a connection to Ishtar? I don't think so, because it's Ish. Ish v'Isha, right? It's man and woman. Okay, roots, fine. I can see the rain clouds from my apartment in Ashkelon. Okay, we have a lot of interesting conversations here about Eliyahu and being tamed, right? Okay, you guys all, you know, understood my conclusion before I got to it. Not John Paul, Paul, thank you. I got my popes mixed up. Yes, John Pope, Special Road, correct. Paul the Sixth. Thank you. Sorry, I got my popes mixed up. Parallels between Achav and Navot and David and Uriah. Interesting, right? Because Achav does do some kind of atonement, some kind of tshuva. And David also accepted right away when he does tshuva. Interesting. I don't think I've ever read anything about that, but I hear what you're saying. Achav is killed in battle.
Truly, just a minute. I think what she's referring to is they were both, Achav didn't do it, but they were both, their deaths, the deaths of the two people were engineered.
Ah, that's what the parallels that you're saying. Okay, but I also see the parallel of the atonement. But yes, that's true too, right? He sends someone else to do the dirty work. Although with Achav and Navot, it's very direct. What was your meaning?
Well, just that he coveted, in each case, they coveted something that belonged to another person, and that in order to acquire it, they then had that person killed.
It's interesting. I don't know if there are any midrashim that compare those two pairs. That's an interesting point. Yeah. All right. Ask Rabbi Alex Israel. Maybe he knows. That's a good idea. Yeah, there you go. Homework for next time. Go ask Alex Israel and tell me, or I can ask him. He's my neighbor. How did Eliyahu travel with Elisha around Israel in one day? Traveling around Israel. Beit El to Yericho to Gilgal is not that far, right? They're all relatively close, a few hours difference. And they walked a lot more in those days than we do. Other questions, comments? Okay. Thank you, everybody. Shabbat Shalom. Next week, we will continue with Melachim Bet, the second book of Melachim. Okay. Have a Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you. Chodesh Tov.
Chodesh Tov.